Welcome to Driven Minds. I'm Gigi, and this is a Type 7 podcast. Our guest today is Jillian Turecki. Jillian is an iconic relationship coach who's been teaching people how to examine and transform their love lives for 20 years. As well as being the host of the Jillian on Love podcast, she offers courses, workbooks, and one-on-one coaching. And guys, whether or not you're in a committed, stable, and loving relationship, I highly recommend checking out Jillian's Instagram account. Her posts read like hard-hitting truth nuggets that will, above all else, encourage you to transform the relationship you have with yourself. Arguably, the most important relationship we'll all ever have. I'm learning this as I go. Just before we recorded this episode, I actually finished her workbook called Grit and Grace, 7 Steps to Survive Heartbreak, which is an excellent source for anyone going through a breakup. So here it is, my conversation with Jillian Turecki. You are one of my favorite accounts to follow.
I love it when you comment, but I think of you as Jillian with a G, but you go by Gigi.
Well, it's actually a whole thing because my original name is Gillian.
Oh, Gillian with a G. Okay, okay.
Yeah. I changed it, though. I've never talked about this on the show, so this is actually a good moment to take advantage of this. First off, it's my nickname. It's what my parents called me ever since I was born. But I got so frustrated with people calling me Jillian because that's just not my name. It's Gillian. Not that Jillian's not a beautiful name.
It's just not your name.
Exactly. So I got so frustrated with correcting people.
I don't blame you.
That I was just like, you know what? It's Gigi now.
That's it. I love the name Gigi, so there you go.
Well, thank you. I love your story as to how you arrived at this work. And for anyone who doesn't know, can you tell us the backstory of how you got into relationship coaching?
Yeah. Okay. So where to begin? So I was a yoga teacher for many years, almost 20 years. I taught classes, but I also worked very closely one-on-one with many, many people on their injuries. And there's always a very close connection between injury and the psychology. For so many years, I've been working with people, teaching them how to form a better connection with themselves and greater self-awareness. And I would say maybe 7 years into teaching or so, I felt like, the ceiling's pretty low. Where does one go from here? And I know that I wanted more, but I didn't know what that looked like. I also knew that I wanted to get married and have kids and do all of that. So it's just a little bit of, I think, the very typical, what do I want to do with my life thing. Mm-hmm. And I ended up getting married.
How old were you when you got married?
I met him like when I was 36, 37. I think we got married when I was 38.
Okay.
It was a 90% great relationship before we got married, and 10% was problematic. But that 10% was really big and shouldn't be ignored. Mm. Marriage doesn't take your problems away. It magnifies your problems. So anyway, it was a really painful marriage. A lot went down. The way it ended was terrible. And I was going through such a hard time in my life because my mom was dying of lung cancer. It was just a complete dark night of the soul, horrible situation. And I became obsessed with the question, which is, what does it take to have like a long-lasting and thriving relationship? Mm-hmm. And I became literally obsessed. And through my journey of trying to heal my heartbreak, I went down this sort of deep, a shamanic journey, if you will, into the self. And I had a lot of coaching mentors that really helped me. And I started to get a lot of insight into why it didn't work, into relationships, into psychology. And I thought, this is what I have to teach. And so I have been studying it and teaching it pretty much every single day since. It's a passion, it's an obsession, and here I am.
Well, you are so good at it. And
I appreciate that.
There's a universality to your work. You know, relationships are the crux of our being. They're evolutionarily speaking, instrumental to our survival. Yet there's still so much mystery and confusion around what constitutes a healthy relationship. And it doesn't matter how smart you are, I find. You can still find yourself in the spiral shame hole of just like, how did I get here? I work on myself. I'm evolved. And you still end up there.
And it's very painful. It has nothing to do with intellect. And it has nothing to do with being a good person.
Well, I want to start off with a really simple and, in my opinion, underrated question, which is, what is a healthy relationship and what does it look like?
Yeah, it's a very good question.
Romantically speaking.
Yeah, because that's where we get triggered the most.
Yeah.
In my opinion, a healthy relationship is a relationship where two people respect each other, they honor each other, and they have a strong, sturdy foundation between the two of them of safety and trust. That is a healthy relationship. Now, within that, everyone has their own style of relating. In other words, not every relationship that's healthy looks exactly the same, but what they all have in common is safety, trust, and respect.
Those words, they almost seem like such platitudes.
Yes.
But there are so many times when I thought that I was in something like that, but there are tons of exceptions, or he respects me except when, or I trust him except when. And that also kind of brought me back to what you said starting off, which is my relationship was good except for that 10%, and that 10% grew. How do you suss that out? And you're like, you know what? This is a recipe for potential disaster.
Because no relationship is perfect, and all couples will have their issues.
Right.
And I think that one of the healthiest things that couples can do is say, you know, oh, is this an issue that really needs to be a problem? Or is this an issue that we can agree to let go of?
Mm-hmm.
I think that the way that we determine it and differentiate it is through communication. It sounds so simple and yet another platitude. However, most couples don't communicate.
Right.
So you notice there's a pattern or something that's come up that's concerning to you. Are you willing to talk about it? Are they willing to talk about it with you? And can you reach resolution around it?
Mm-hmm.
There's always going to be some issues that you don't reach resolution about, but this is something that can be extremely concerning to you.
Right.
It's not a preference. It's like, oh, this really hurts. This is making me question trust. This is making me question if we're right for each other. This is making me question safety. I need to talk about it with them. We need to talk about it. And if you can't communicate about it with each other, if you can't learn and grow from it, then it's a real problem.
When you bring up communication, I think there are a lot of people, I'm one of them, who really has no problem communicating my needs. And the problem is when you communicate something, hey, this bothers me. It bothers me when you interrupt me. It bothers me when you don't ask me how my day is. But then these things keep happening, right? So you can communicate a need, and it's not your partner's responsibility to meet your needs necessarily, right? Your partner cannot meet all of your needs, but there are some basic needs that no matter how many times you communicate them, your partner is just simply unable to follow through with them.
Because it's the way that you communicate. What was the example that you used?
I had a problem with a partner who would just interrupt me constantly.
Okay. So you would just have to say, look, I really appreciate what you have to say, but you've got a bad habit of interrupting me.
Mm-hmm.
I need to feel heard by you. And when you interrupt, I feel like I'm not really being heard by you. And like part of being heard is love for me.
Mm.
I know your intention is not to make me feel this way. I think it's a habit of yours. But I'm letting you know how it makes me feel, and I'd like for you to work on it. And so if you present it like that, and then partner B says, okay, like, I don't want you to feel unheard. Like, you're right. I kind of do interrupt people a lot. I'm going to really work on this. That's a great example of something that I think is good teamwork. If it's met with defensiveness, if it's met with, like putting you down or just not, or being cavalier, well, then that's the red flag.
I want to talk about red flags, actually.
Okay.
Because no matter how large they are or how plainly they wave in my face, I still tend to walk right through them thinking, but this is an exception. What are non-negotiable red flags we should not ignore?
Wait, question though, but this is an exception or you're the exception?
I had a relationship where this guy was literally a walking red flag.
Okay.
The other problem also was that he was open to working on himself. So was open to going to therapy, was open to getting sober.
So that's a project.
Right. But the problem is like, it's also my life.
I know, but you saw him as a project.
He took literally 100% of my time.
Of course, because he was your project. Because you said, oh, he's a walking red flag, but he's willing to do the work. I'll be the woman that will be by his side while he does the work, even though I don't know him.
Right, right. Right.
Why would you sign up for that?
Because there were so many other things that were really beautiful. Our connection.
Connection, attraction. It's always that. It's always going to be attraction that's going to bite everyone in the ass.
Why is that though?
I think that this is changing for younger women, much younger, like girls, teenagers. But a lot of women go into relationships thinking that they can reform their partner or they could be the guiding light angel as their partner reforms. Mm. And then it makes us feel really important. It makes us feel like a healer. It makes us feel significant. It makes us feel needed mm-hmm. and wanted. But it's a bad habit.
And meanwhile, I think I at least completely lost myself in the relationship. I've stopped doing all the things that I love doing, like working out and meditating. I mean, all of that disappeared.
Yeah, because that's the codependent narrative.
So how would one extricate themselves from something when you acknowledge that it's a codependent, toxic relationship?
Okay, I will answer that. But first, I just want to be very clear because codependent relationship, I know I brought it up, but it's one of those things that all the like younger, modern day therapists, coaches all over social media like to use and they use it too much. Mm-hmm. So to be clear, what I at least mean by a codependent relationship is codependent relationships, it takes two to tango.
Yeah.
So you are unconsciously depending on this person being broken and you get to fix everything or try to fix everything and you put all your focus on them and you ignore yourself. And they really are getting a lot of their needs met being the focal point of the relationship, even if that's not conscious. Hmm. So that's a codependent relationship. Does that ring true for you?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
For sure.
So how do you get out of it? Well, the first step is to recognize, and you might need a third party to do this for you, is to recognize what the consequences are of not changing. Mm-hmm. What the consequences are, because I don't think that we meditate enough on how easy it is to completely fuck up our lives by remaining in the wrong relationship. And you will staying in those kinds of relationships.
What kind of relationships exactly?
Where one person is trying to reform the other. Mm-hmm. Because the other is a walking red flag. Mm-hmm. And the person who's in the relationship with the walking red flag doesn't want to see the person that's in front of them. They want to see the potential. They keep making excuses.
Yeah.
This is the example of someone who can really screw up their life easily if they remain in those kinds of relationships.
And for anyone asking themselves if they should leave a relationship, what questions should they ask themselves, assuming that no one is in danger?
Am I happy in this relationship is the first question a person should ask. And if the answer is no, say, okay, why not? Am I not happy because I haven't been communicating? Am I not happy because something just feels really off about our compatibility? Am I not happy because I'm just not happy in life in general? That's the starting point.
What was the most effective first step that you took to begin dealing with the grief of your breakup?
Definitely relying on friends, family, and a therapist. So just asking for help. That's the first and most important thing. You need a support system is very, very, very important. It doesn't have to be a large one, but just, you know, anyone. So that's the first step.
What are just definitive red flags to look out for in a partner?
And in ourselves.
And in ourselves, yes.
So violence of any kind, if they're violent towards you with their words, with their actions, with physical violence, that's first of all, the biggest red flag is violence. Mm-hmm. Any addiction that's not met with sobriety. Why do you want to get into a relationship with someone who's an addict who is claiming they're going to work on themselves? That's very different than being in love, having a spouse, and they're having a problem, and you're going to stick by their side mm-hmm. while they go through that. For someone you barely know, why would you sign up for that? And I see women and men doing it all the time, and it's a huge mistake. It never ends well.
What have you found as the reason?
Because they want to fix them.
Right.
Because of connection, because of attraction, because of falling in love with potential. Mm-hmm. Also, what is their tolerance for anger? In other words, how are they angry? Do they weaponize their anger? What's going on with that? And we're also talking about addiction, like porn addiction, sex addiction, all kinds of addiction. Mm-hmm. Everyone has other red flags. Like there's little ones, like someone who has no self-awareness. They haven't done any work on themselves.
Right.
They're shit-talking their ex while taking absolutely no accountability. A red flag is someone who has, I think, really terrible friends.
Oh, God. Wow.
Yeah. I think we learn a lot about someone's character based on the people who they surround themselves with on a regular basis. And I don't think that we take that under consideration enough.
Talk about like dating for potential and red flags and everything. I've also had so many friends that have dated these guys where the friend group unanimously said, you got to get out of this. And the girl would stay with him and the guy would slowly change. And, you know, I do find a lot of my friends grappling and even myself hoping maybe this is the exception, you know?
I know. And it's really, it's really dangerous.
Do you have any advice how we can see people as they are now instead of being blinded by what they can potentially be?
By telling yourself, I'm going to pay attention. I'm going to see who they are now. Because a lot of this, what you're speaking to is a self-esteem issue. Anyone who remains in a relationship with someone where they're being abused has low self-esteem.
And abuse can take many forms.
Yes, violent words, name calling, spitting, pushing, shoving. We're all manipulators, but really covert manipulation and gaslighting and all of that, like really, really nasty stuff. I would say that that's abuse versus just immature behavior, which is not necessarily abuse, but can still be a nightmare nonetheless.
Can you talk about those low-key signifiers or red flags?
Because
I feel like there are some things that are like capital G, get out, and then there are lowercase get out.
Totally. There's unhealthy behavior and there's abusive behavior. So it's like, you know, someone who every time you get into an argument, they never take accountability. They never apologize and they always blame.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that as abuse, but I see that as pretty shitty behavior.
Right.
Or, you know, every time they get into an argument, they completely shut down and sort of like don't want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's dysfunctional behavior.
Mm-hmm.
High functioning adults in a relationship communicate. Now, they're not constantly talking about the relationship. That's exhausting. But they accept one another for who they are. They have boundaries with each other about how they're going to be treated. And they communicate with each other. They repair with each other.
Mm-hmm.
The couples that really are strong, they talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about the hard things.
A problem that comes up for me as well as many of my friends is when you do communicate and you say, hey, this is what bothers me. And for this reason, I don't feel seen. I don't feel heard. The person acknowledges it, said they'll work on it, but it just keeps happening again and again. So how do you marry this duality between this one person saying, hey, I hear you. I see you. I'm going to work on myself. I'm going to get better. I'm not going to do this anymore. And then with repeated behavior.
One thing that I've learned, because I used to work a lot with couples for years, is that we change with positive reinforcement. As humans, we're very similar to dogs in that punishment doesn't work, but positive reinforcement does work. So one thing that I've seen people do, and I've seen women do this a lot, is they're not changing fast enough. So I'm going to keep complaining, as opposed to recognizing when their partner is putting in an effort and being like, I really appreciate that effort you put in. Yes, that's what I like. You got to train your partner. We are very trainable and we need to be trainable. And I would say that a good partner is a trainable partner. Like we need to be willing to be trained a little bit. I remember having a boyfriend a long time ago. And one of the things that I really liked about him was that I could train him. As long as I was doing my job of being like, this is what I really like. This is what I really like. He'd be like, great, I'll do more of what you really like. But I had to tell him that.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes we ask for change behavior and then we don't appreciate the effort.
Mm-hmm.
And then we don't give positive reinforcement. So let's just suppose you really are doing that, which most people don't, but let's just suppose you are.
Communicating needs.
No, not communicating needs, reinforcing their partner's change behavior with positive reinforcement. So it's not just like, you know, here are my needs, you better meet them. It's a conversation. We all come from different backgrounds and different families, right? So you could say, this is my boundary, this is my need. But are you willing to give the person you love or the person that you are very interested in learning how to love some time to kind of adjust to your boundary if it's something that they have never in their family have never had to face before. So it's not about like, these are my needs. It has to be a conversation. These are my needs. What do you think about that? Can you meet them? Like, what are your thoughts on that? Like, how can I help you meet this need? And by the way, like, what can I do for you? So I think that we have to get away from this narrative that's like, here are my needs. Look, that narrative is an important narrative for the woman and the man who has very low self-esteem and has a pattern, has a history, a trail of being treated like a doormat. So that person, I'm going to coach very differently. Right. I'm going to say, assert, 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 needs, 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 boundaries, boundaries, boundaries. But let's just say we're just talking about people with the average self-esteem, and then that's not happening. Ideally, when we talk about needs in a relationship, it's a conversation. It's not a demand.
I want to go back to leaving a toxic relationship.
Sure.
And I love your ebook, by the way. I downloaded it. I'm obsessed with it. The workbook's incredible. It has helped me leaps and bounds.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Thank you.
What are some concrete pieces of advice for someone to leave a relationship that does not work for them? Because I find that I at least get so flustered, struggle with the pains of attachment and loneliness, and end up prolonging relationships far longer than they should last.
Yeah.
And it is so difficult to extricate yourself. What are concrete ways we can do this?
Rally up your troops, your friends, your family, your support group, your therapist, whatever you've got. Have your support there. Let them know that this is what you're planning to do. And then go no contact. Have a conversation with them. Cry, blubber, all of that. Cry yourself to sleep as much as you need to, but you need to go completely no contact. And what you can do is also write down a list of what the consequences are staying in a relationship that is unhealthy for you 5 years, 10 years down the road, knowing that you're still in it. One has to really connect themselves to the pain that will be if you remain. Because what happens is, understandably, all we do is focus on the pain of severing that attachment. And we don't focus on how much we are going to hate ourselves for staying. Because wasted time is a very, very, very large source of deep suffering. You have to write down the list, the consequences of me staying here, and write it all down. And then you could write down everything that you're going to gain from not being with them. Freedom, not having to talk about the relationship all the time, the lack of stress, that vacation you want to take. So I think that writing all that down is very important. Have your support group on call, knowing that you need them, and then you go no contact for a period of time.
And why is no contact so important?
Have you ever gone no contact before?
I have.
And did it help?
I've had both. With great loves, I've done no contact, and then I had a relationship. It was a year. We went no contact for like 2 months probably. And then I'm literally can meet him for coffee, can meet him for a burger, like have no problem.
That's great.
But the big X, the big love, like it was like no Instagram, stop stalking. I stopped doing everything because even seeing his face with another woman tore a hole in my heart that I didn't even know was possible.
Right. So usually these unhealthy relationships that we're referring to are very, very attached and bonded and addictive. So the no contact and removing any, like you said, any temptation to look at social media is going to give you the space to heal. People don't realize that the most important thing when a relationship ends is your own healing. That's all. And you have to do everything you possibly can in the service of that healing.
It's interesting though, because I guess there's so many times where the healing hurts so badly that you're like, I just need to do one check-in, you know, that one check-in, that one Band-Aid.
I know.
What do we do when we find ourselves in that moment where we're like, I just need to check in. I need to just one quick, whatever it is, if it's a glance at his Instagram, some point of contact. What do we do in that moment where we're dying to get to them when we know it's not good for us?
Every relationship is different. When a marriage ends, for example, the breaking up and the divorcing is over several weeks and months. So I don't want anyone listening to feel bad thinking that they have to go no contact right away. Like sometimes it's a process when it's a very, very important and deep relationship. But if it's like just an unhealthy relationship and it's just been a lot of back and forth, are you into sugar?
Yeah.
What's your like thing that like if you have one, you'll eat the whole bag?
Oh, like sour gummy worms.
Okay, sour. Oh, that's funny. Interesting. Okay, so you have a candy thing. Okay. Do you ever stop yourself from eating them? Do you have any sort of self-control or discipline when it comes to them?
I haven't bought a bag in probably 15 years.
Okay, so what I need to know is something that like right now, currently, you have to sometimes have some discipline over.
Mine is attachment, Jillian. Like my addiction is attachment. Okay. That's where I have no self-control.
Yeah, but you do. Everyone has self-control. But you're getting certain needs met with this. For you, I don't know because I don't know you, but it's like maybe you're addicted to drama.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you get bored really easily and these kinds of relationships are a very good distraction from your boredom.
Mm-hmm.
But you are in control. There are some people, it's like a Sour Patch or chocolate or a French fry. Sure, it would be fine if they could have a couple, but a lot of people, it's like, I'm gonna eat the whole thing and then I'm gonna wake up the next day and I'm gonna have a stomach ache and I'm gonna feel like shit. It's the same thing with the ex. At some point, you just have to say, I gotta go no contact because it's like that bag of potato chips. It's going to make me really sick and I'm just gonna have to challenge myself to be strong.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole idea is like, well, I don't have any control over it. That is a story. And people are more addicted to that story than they are to the actual person. You are in control of your behavior.
Right.
It's hard. And you might have to call your therapist instead. And you might have to cry. But it can be done. But again, how do we break any bad habit? Two things. We associate enough pain with continuing the habit. And then number two, we replace it with a better habit.
What issues do you find come up in your practice most amongst millennials? Single millennials.
Single millennials, self-esteem issues, for sure.
Can you give some examples?
Yeah, same thing, like tolerating less than that they deserve or just dating and just kind of like giving the wrong people a chance, feeling very obsessed with their loneliness when they don't have a relationship instead of just kind of like doing things. I understand wanting to be in a relationship, but I also know like to suffer until you are in a relationship is not a good strategy. So it's like focusing on themselves. Those are the main issues for sure.
So what advice would you give to someone who, you know, finds themselves single and is always on dating apps or always trying to go out and always on the lookout for the next person? What advice would you give someone to just reconnect with themselves and make themselves the protagonist in their own lives?
I would tell them to get off the apps, and I wouldn't necessarily tell them to become the protagonist of their own lives unless they were really just low self-esteem. I would tell them to start doing more things with their life so that they expand their circle. I would tell them to start stepping outside of their comfort zone, meeting new people, making more friends, trying to build more community, give back in some way, and actually expand their circle, expand their perspective, and make their world larger. Instead of just looking for that person, because that person will walk into your life when you really do make your world larger. That's my recommendation. I think that this idea that like finding the right person for you should be easy is ridiculous. It's not easy, but it's never been, because everyone's like, it's harder now than ever. No, finding love is a centuries old conundrum. Like it's written about in novels from like the 16th century. It's not that easy. It's not impossible, but it's not that easy. And people have been doing it for centuries before the dating app ever came onto the scene. So if the dating app is just feeling tired for you, get off them and do it the old-fashioned way. Start meeting new people, start doing different things, start stepping outside your comfort zone, make your life more interesting to you. and then see what happens.
Do you believe in when you know, you know?
Depends who's saying it.
What do you mean?
Because I've heard a lot of people say that and they don't know what they're talking about. You know, they end up with someone who's actually horrible for them. But if I hear that from someone who's not always saying that, maybe I'd be more apt to listen.
I guess it's always just this eternal question of like, how much do you compromise? And I talk to a lot of women that think, well, maybe my standards are too high and I'm asking for too much and I'm looking for this person that doesn't even exist.
Yes.
What's your response to that?
Something that I've learned is that as you get older, your priorities shift.
Totally.
And they also get more refined. As you get older, you're like, I just want someone with amazing character and we just get along great. Mm-hmm. And all the rest I will deal with. And so your non-negotiables and your deal breakers should actually be a pretty small list, but they should be incredibly meaningful.
It's interesting. My godbrother gave me marriage advice like 6 years ago when I was thinking of marrying my ex-boyfriend, and his relationship with his wife is beautiful. And I said, you know, what's your advice for a good marriage? And he says, marry someone it's easy with. And when I heard that, I was so disappointed. I was like, that is the most unromantic thing I've ever heard.
I love it.
And now 6 years later, I'm like, that sounds awesome.
Awesome. Yeah. Relationships, even the easy one, there's still labor within it, right? Like you still have to communicate. You still have to be honest. You still have to negotiate. Mm-hmm. So you might as well do it with someone where it's like pretty easy. And so I love that advice. Too many people, and this is, I was that person too. So it's definitely not a judgment. Like you have to work on becoming whole on your own and really get honest about yourself, about whether or not you want a relationship to fill some voids. I remember one person saying to me, the reason why I want a relationship is for emotional security. And I said, well, you're going to have a lot of problems because you need to feel secure without the relationship. And then you can be in a relationship. Yes, you need emotional security in the relationship, but you don't go to a relationship to feel secure because guess what? Relationships are very challenging in the sense that they will challenge our security once in a while. So it's important that you have your own life. You don't want to control someone else's life, and you don't want to use someone else's life as a filler for a void inside of you.
I have such a hard time, though, accepting that fact with the biological component, which is throughout evolution, two people becoming one physiological unit was a survival mechanism. And it's difficult to kind of reconcile these two ideas of how can we be expected to maintain a level of differentiation if our biology is so influenced by our partner, or this idea of, oh, we don't need anyone and we can just like Henry David Thoreau this and live in a cabin for a year. But in reality, I used to be like, oh, I feel lonely. I want someone to hold me at night. Like that's insane. I have to hold myself.
But no. That's not insane. You're judging something. You can hug yourself, but that's not, human touch is very important. Human connection is very important.
Right.
You can feel lonely and want that love. That is not a problem. That is not a problem. I'm talking about the day-to-day, being able to actually live your life without feeling like you cannot access joy at all unless you have a partner. It's not that they can never have like a laugh, but they're really struggling to find meaning in life because they're not in a relationship.
And what modalities can you recommend for someone who does want to work on their self-esteem, that wants to be a more complete whole version of themselves? What can they do, accessible steps to turn to start their journey?
Well, definitely listen to my podcast, Jillian on Love.
Agreed.
Listen to your podcast. I mean, that's like basically what my whole membership is about. But let's just talk about things that they can do that has nothing to do with that. I think that one of the most effective ways to build your self-esteem is to spend time with friends who love you, even if it's just one friend, and to give back in some way, to start doing things that make it so that you're not the protagonist of your life, paradoxically, meaning it's not all about you. There's like lots of people who need your help. Start helping. I think that those two things are huge. And then the third, which is a little bit vaguer, is face some fears. And you can start with very low-hanging small fruit, but start facing some fears a little bit every day and keep some promises to yourself. And this is incredibly fortifying for the relationship with yourself.
Last question. What drives you?
Lots of things drive me. Love drives me. My work drives me. Yoga drives me. My dog drives me. So when I think about all those things and what they all have in common, I think that they all have in common like connection. That's really what drives me the most, for sure. And on days where I'm sort of burnt out, maybe what's driving me is, you know, needing some sense of achievement. But that's sort of like when I'm in balance. When I go underneath all of that ego stuff, really it's the need to feel like I'm giving back in some way, or I'm connecting with people in some way.
That, my friends, was Jillian Turecki. You can follow Jillian on Instagram at Jillian Turecki, that's Jillian with a J. And you can follow me at Gillian Zagansky, Gillian with a G. As always, I want to hear what you think of this episode or any episode. So shoot me a DM, let me know your comments, questions, concerns, who you want to hear from next, etc. Until next time.